I can't believe Peter Baker's mother.
Wait, I don't know about Peter's mother.
Oh, my God. She's being
honored.
Your mother-in-law, Peter Baker's mother, is 83 and was just honored for her ice hockey playing. She's still playing.
How did it I was
not,
amazing.
This is squarely in my wheelhouse. Why have I not been briefed on the
Peter's mother has the Guinness Book of World Record. This is a true story for being the oldest woman hockey player. Actually, the Washington Capitals had her drop the puck at their game on Saturday night, along with a couple other young women ranging from the age of 6 years old up to her at age 83.
Wait, do you realize what a big deal she would be in our household? Because the Guinness Book of World Records is a looms large in the life of 8-year-olds and 6-year-olds.
That is a big, thing, those annual books. Oh, my God, Theo, love
those. We loved those books.
But the thing is, we have to do a lot of explaining because the kids don't draw a distinction between, Usain Bolt, who's in there for having achieved the mastery of a physical discipline, and then the person who has the most number of cigarettes in their nose. And they regard both of these.
But that's why it's so great. I mean, I spent so much time looking at the fattest man in the world and the person with the longest fingernails.
That picture, right? That always freaks you out.
The kids can't get it. And the number of times I've been asked, Daddy, can we please look up in the book again who's the tallest baby? And I keep having to talk to them about how this is really also an epistemic discussion about measurable things.
And you use that phrase. You say, this is children. Gather around while I tell you an epistemic discussion.
They love epistemic discussions.
What a didactic dad.
And a didactic dad.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Jane Mayer, and I'm joined by my colleagues Susan Glasser and Evan Osnos. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
Hi, Evan.
Good morning, guys.
Much of the spotlight this year so far in the presidential race has been on domestic politics. But among the sharpest disagreements between President Biden and Donald Trump are in how they see the world. From the wars in Ukraine and Gaza to escalating tensions with China, American foreign policy is on the brink this year, and it seems on the ballot. So this week, we're looking at President Biden and Trump's clashing worldviews and how foreign policy is shaping the 2024 election so far. Let's start with this week's vote in the House around, of all things, TikTok. On Wednesday, the House passed a bill that could lead to a ban on the hugely popular video app unless it's put under non-Chinese ownership. The bill grew out of concerns that TikTok's owner may be aligned with or even controlled by the Chinese government, posing national security risks to Americans. So, hey, Evan, you're the China expert here. This bill passed in the House 352-65. Why did it get such a broad bipartisan amount of support?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you could get a bill in support of apple pie that would get quite that number of votes. I think it's the intersection of two big, juicy subjects for Congress right now, which is China and big tech. And China in particular has become this little island of unity in Congress, this sort of area of bipartisanship. And, you know, what the bill calls for is, it's worth sort of noting the details. It basically says that TikTok has to be sold by ByteDance, which is its owner, within 6 months, or it would face a ban on the app stores in the U.S. And it's kind of bounced around over the years. We're going to talk about the way that TikTok at various times has been embraced or rejected by the various candidates. But it happens to find itself sitting at that perfect sweet spot of two things that members of Congress want to go after.
I mean, isn't Biden in a somewhat contradictory position, given the fact that he's just recently released an ad for his campaign on TikTok?
But well, he's also saying he welcomes the platform.
He's on the platform, but at the same time, he's saying he welcomes this bill banning it and will sign it. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the main reason that actually you saw it kind of go on the floor of the House and move so quickly. This is something that Congress has been obsessing over literally for the last few years. And almost out of nowhere, you see the action at the same time that Congress is holding up By the way, any action on the national security funding for real conflicts in Ukraine and Israel and with Taiwan to support Taiwan, you see them doing nothing on that. And yet somehow they're able to magically put a bill about TikTok on the floor almost overnight. And I think that is reflective of how much Congress has sort of degraded and become a platform for political messaging bills at the expense of, actual legislation. And that's really notable. I would also point out that Congress hasn't even passed its funding bills for 2023 and is still passing a series of continuing resolutions because they can't get their work done there. So let's just stipulate that this is all about politics and messaging, first of all. Second of all, to your point about President Biden, I think it's really quite striking that Biden has now taken a legislative position that seems to be exactly at odds with where his campaign is all about. We've got to meet people where they are. We've got to be on the platforms where Americans are. And every 4 years, right, campaigns basically are studying the media universe and trying to figure out how to connect with Americans at a time when how Americans get their information is changing. And let's be blunt. Biden has a young person problem, and I don't think it's going to be helping him that at the exact moment when they're in crisis to try to get young voters who did help him win election over Trump in 2020, when they're trying to bring them back on board. Right now, what I hear, you know, talking to my university son is that kids increasingly don't see enough of a difference between the two parties. And, you know, while they've historically been liberal leaning, this is actually a huge problem for Democrats going into the election. Banning their favorite app that they're addicted to, I'm not sure that that's good politics.
Do you think that explains why Trump has flip-flopped on it? I mean, Trump, when he was president, condemned TikTok as a national security threat because it was owned by a Chinese company. Now he's kind of backing off that and saying, well, not so fast. I think it might be a good thing. What happened with that?
Look, Trump has moved around on this issue for a variety of reasons we can talk about, one of which is that Kellyanne Conway, one of his principal advisors, is now lobbying on behalf of TikTok, has met with at least 10 lawmakers at various points to make TikTok's case. She, of course, is on the payroll there. So
sounds kind of swampy as opposed to draining the swamp.
Well, and by the way, speaking of the Trump connection, Evan, you've got Kellyanne Conway, who is an unregistered lobbyist, it should be pointed out. She has not officially registered to lobby.
Oh, God, what a term, by the way. Unregistered lobbyist.
Yeah, exactly. It's like just a little bit bad, right? also reports that Steve Mnuchin, who was Trump's Treasury Secretary, has raised his hand and volunteered just very conveniently to take it off their hands and to put together a group of investors to purchase TikTok, which obviously would have enormous value here in the United States. So, you know,
how convenient.
Exactly.
Now, I mean, also reports that one of the biggest donors to Republican politics, Jeffrey Yass, paid a house call to Mar-a-Lago to talk to Trump about this just before Trump changed his point of view.
And, well, so and Jane, for people who don't know, remind us who Jeffrey Yass is.
He's a guy who's in finance from the Philadelphia area who's pouring money into American politics and has been for quite some time.
And interestingly, he has libertarian. Like 15% or something of TikTok.
Right, of course. I meant to mention he has a huge investment in TikTok. So I mean, but
I saw that Bloomberg this week had him on a list of potential Treasury Secretaries for Trump if he comes back and wins election.
So there's something else he wants. Yes.
And we wonder why young people are disenchanted by politics.
Everybody has an incentive here. But I think this, I'm just laughing, like this is not your grandfather's foreign policy conversation that we're having here, right? Like,
but it is. It actually is a very good foreign policy conversation, given the effect of the social media on politics worldwide. I think, but I have to wonder, is Congress asking the right question? I mean, this particular policy discussion seems to me kind of off the mark. The real question ought to be, what kind of regulations should the United States put on these social media platforms? Not who owns them, because I mean, while it may be, you know, a threat to national security in the eyes of many to have a Chinese company owning it, I'm not sure that the answer is to have Steve Mnuchin owning it for the good of America either.
Well, I mean, Evan, how much do you have better insight, I feel like, than we do into the kind of Chinese state theory of the case when it comes to data and privacy? It's certainly from a distance, from here in Washington, it definitely appears that, you know, one of the things that's made Xi's rule so effective is its almost sort of modern dystopian leveraging of data and personal information and technology to impose a level of control on Chinese society that, you know, is something that his predecessors would have only dreamed of. And so I do admit to a great amount of discomfort at the idea of this incredible data, because anywhere I walk in the United States now, when I go to the airport, I see people slack-jawed like zombies staring at TikTok, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I think on one hand, there are elements of TikTok that are pretty similar to other social media apps in terms of the risks they pose to our, let's call it our illusion of free will. you know, the idea that they're collecting data on us constantly, that you can make subtle adjustments in what a person sees in ways that they don't even fully apprehend, but are ultimately really shaping their perception of events. The difference here, and it is a big difference, is that it's just a fact that a Chinese company in China, even when it erects barriers around itself for independence, ultimately is subject to the whims of an authoritarian government. And it is able at a moment's notice to decide, okay, everything that was the law yesterday is not the law today. And you just literally have no ability to change that. I think that for a long time, and this is worth, I think, pointing out, there were people in the United States who were wary of the idea of going after TikTok because it's similar to other social media networks. But over time, TikTok has not done itself any favors. You know, Kevin Roos in the New York Times had a good column pointing out that TikTok, in fact, has responded to it by marshaling its users to inundate Congress with requests to change course, which in its own way is proof of concept. It shows right there that TikTok is able, in effect, to steer these currents of public opinion. And so it sort of undermines their claim that they're, you know, they're just observers here.
Yeah. And I think that there's a really important point, too, that in a way it's not so much even the software as it is the algorithm that is the value proposition in TikTok, that it is controlling what people see when they see it. That is, first of all, a power to that literally the power to potentially shape people's minds strikes me as something that is quite different than we're used to thinking of traditional media. And then on the data front, I was persuaded recently when I was reading and thinking about, you know, imagine change China for Russia here and look back to what's already occurred in our elections as opposed to even some theoretical future threat. Having that amount of data on individuals would theoretically enable you to conduct extremely sophisticated phishing operations where you would actually literally have, you know, not only a person's contacts, who was in their email, who they're interacting with, but their own preferences, likes, and social network all mapped out for you.
I actually wonder how this got this far, really, with the social media platforms having so little regulation. Because if you go back to the history of television in this country, to own a television station, you could not be a foreign owner. And
yeah,
so
Rupert Murdoch had to become a U.S. citizen in order to own a bunch of.
Look how well that worked out.
Well, I mean, the thing is, there actually were barriers. It's just that there have been none for social media. And so it's slipped in this way. Well, anyway, let's take a break. And when we come back, how Biden and Trump are each navigating the war in Ukraine.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
As we saw in the State of the Union, President Biden has made supporting Ukraine a key issue in his presidency and campaign. However, aside from a minor infusion of aid this week, there's still no plan for sustained support from the U.S. for Ukraine. Evan, how is the Biden administration thinking about the next phase of the war?
I think it resonates with them on the level of real worldview, that this is not just about specifically Ukraine, but it has to do with this larger question of the illiberal turn in the world, the assault on free societies. I mean, that's certainly the way that Joe Biden thinks of it. He talks about it now as the central cause of my presidency is pushing back not only on the threats to democracy here in the United States, but also in Ukraine and elsewhere. As a functional sort of tactical matter, there is a real concern, I think a pretty credible timetable in the minds of members of this administration that if something doesn't change, if the United States does not provide more arms and ammunition to Ukraine, that you'll begin to see by the summertime that they will lose the ability to repel Russian attacks, if not sooner.
Well, they're already running out of ammunition on the ground. There's an argument. Ukrainian commanders have made the case that they just suffered a major defeat in a town called Avdiivka that they had to cede to the Russians, and that might not have happened had it not been. But it's also, to Evan's point about the Biden administration, it's a key test of the president's credibility. We're talking about this in the frame of an election year context. And the bottom line is that Biden has seen this as a signature foreign policy issue for him. The idea that he is standing up for the West under assault, that is at risk. Biden has made the statement again and again that we will be supporting Ukraine as long as it takes. And actually, it's been more than a year since there was a significant amount of assistance passed by Congress. Biden's request for more than $60 billion of assistance was made to Congress last fall. They wrapped it together with a request for aid to Israel and Taiwan as well.
Susan, I'm jumping out of my chair here because you've done the whole thing as a test of Biden's credibility without saying that Republicans are the ones.
Well, that's literally what I'm about to say.
But I mean, it is the primary fact of this discussion. You can't sort of say that it's a test of Biden's credibility without saying that Republicans have utterly failed to fulfill what is their historic commitment to protecting freedom against Soviet aggression and then Russian aggression. I find it just kind of, I can't sort of describe it as a test of Biden's credibility without acknowledging that the Republicans have utterly forsaken any credibility on this.
Well, I mean, maybe it's a test of the United States credibility,
right?
Because the test is more in the eyes of the world than in the American voters, probably. I would think every ally of the United States is watching this and saying, what good are these people? You know, if they promise huge amounts of aid,
yeah,
and then they just, you know, then they lose interest. It's the most fickle allies you could find.
Look, the reason that makes it even more extraordinary is that it's Donald Trump that almost single-handedly stopped Republicans from moving forward on this bill. And you can say that the Biden administration miscalculated, you know, tactically speaking. They waited a long time to bring this up. They banked on the strong support that they had among Senate Republicans, and they thought that that was enough. They understandably thought, well, listen, the American people still support assistance to Ukraine, and there's still a majority in probably both houses of Congress that support this assistance. What they didn't fully bank on was Donald Trump, whose extraordinary malign influence has basically single-handedly caused House Republicans to balk at this and to say no more. And what I was starting to say was, since October, when Biden sent the bill up, Republicans have delayed, obfuscated, and essentially made it clear how much Trump is calling the shots in their caucus. The big picture is there's still probably a decent chance that they get some, but not the full $60 billion worth of assistance to Ukraine sometime in the next couple months. But that's it. And that's not enough to fund a long-term war against Russia.
But you know,
this war is on the ballot this November. The fate of Ukraine hinges on the presidential election this November. And if Donald Trump is elected, Ukraine's prospects to survive as an intact, independent nation are extremely at risk.
Well, we got a period,
full stop. But I think it's important.
Doesn't matter whether people pay attention to it or not.
When you say that it's at the feet of the Biden administration for relying too much on Republicans in the Senate, for waiting too long to do this thing, that's like saying that they should have expected that the arsonist who lives next door is going to burn down their house and therefore they should have moved. It's kind of, you have to put this, you have to begin, you know, we started this conversation today saying that young people don't make an adequate distinction between Republicans and Democrats right now. And I think it's partly because we're not calling a spade in this way. It is the Republicans who are blocking the United States from supporting Ukraine. Full stop. Full stop. You can say that it's a political, tactical error to not anticipate their obstructionism, but I don't think it's fair to say that it's the Biden administration's fault for not adequately anticipating the degree to which Republicans were prepared to sell Ukraine down the river.
Well, they should. If they cared about the future of Ukraine, then it would.
Who? The Republicans or the Democrats?
The Democrats. Evan, again, wait, this is an absurd non-agreement because there's nobody who's been more critical of Donald Trump. I think you have to be clear-eyed and realistic about the situation that you're dealing with. And by thinking that Republicans were anything other than irresponsible tools of Donald Trump, you can make a lot of tactical errors in American politics.
Okay, I'm going to weigh in here as the third wheel and just say, I think Democrats have consistently underestimated the obstructionism and the nihilism of the new Republican Party. Yeah. On the other hand, I have to say, even if they'd done it earlier, even if Biden had done everything right, I believe that the Republicans would have found a way to blow it all up anyway, because that's what they do. This is what the party is about at this point. So I'm not sure you can really blame that it is a tactical error. I think you've got a clash of visions here. And I think we're getting a little glimpse right now into exactly what a Trump administration might mean in terms of Ukraine, because just this last week, Trump hosted Hungary's prime minister and Putin ally Viktor Orban at Mar-a-Lago. And it was very revealing. Afterwards, Orban claimed that Trump promised there'd be no more aid to Ukraine if he were elected.
Not one penny. Yes.
So we can see what this future holds. So what's Trump's official position on the war in Ukraine? How does he make his case on Ukraine to the American people? Will he make his case directly?
Well, what's remarkable about Trump is that it's not so much even about any bit of assistance to Ukraine or not. He actually doesn't believe, he accepts Putin's argument that Ukraine isn't even a real country. And he now on the campaign trail, interestingly, Jane, to your question, he doesn't so much say, well, you know, I'm going to basically hand the country over to Putin. What he says is this sort of fantasy notion that he's peddling in general in his campaign, which is, well, if I was president, A, this war never would have happened, and B, I will magically solve it within 24 hours. Just elect me and all your problems will go away. And that I found I did the crazy self-assignment of listening to all 1 hour and 55 minutes of Trump's rally the other night in Georgia this week for my column. And, you know, what he's spinning is a kind of fool's gold, a kind of a dictator solution for his followers in which all of our problems, both internationally and domestic, will kind of melt away and he will solve them. And that is on foreign policy particularly notable because, of course, on foreign policy is where American presidents have so much unilateral power already. So you can see the distilled essence of someone. And again, the distilled essence of Donald Trump has been to favor Russia and Putin at every turn. And that's why I'm saying in the end that it is more or less a tactical fight over this aid bill to Ukraine right now, because the real future of the country depends on our election this fall.
I mean, what he's really selling is capitulation.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. That's how you solve a war in 24 hours,
right.
Is you force the Ukrainians to give in to the Russians. I mean, I think there is nothing less than that on the line.
Let's take a break. When we come back, how Biden and Trump are navigating the Israel-Hamas war and what all of this can tell us about how Biden and Trump view America's place in the world.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's turn to the Israel-Hamas war for a minute. The Biden administration has announced plans to build a pier off of the coast of Gaza to supply aid. Biden has also stepped up his criticism of Netanyahu, saying he's hurting Israel more than helping. So, Evan, how much do you think voters' frustrations with the situation are forcing Biden's hand right now?
You know, look, Biden, as you can see pretty obviously, is trapped between these two instincts. One is to continue to work this behind the scenes with Bibi Netanyahu, even though Bibi Netanyahu shows almost a sort of contemptuous disregard for any effort by Biden or the administration to do anything. And then the other instinct, which is this is the, you know, 50 years of politics talking, that he looks out and he has a pretty realistic understanding of the effect this has on young people, on voters of color, on Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. So that is where he sits. And so you find them getting more and more explicit in ways of trying to go around Israel without doing the thing that is probably the hardest for him to ever imagine doing, which is renouncing any kind of practical support for Israel's military capacity. I think that's where he lives, in that purgatory between the two.
It's creating a somewhat incoherent policy, though, isn't it, where we're floating aid in through the sea and going along with Israel denying aid on land or rather just allowing trickles of it on land? I mean, I'm not sure that this policy is something that's going to resonate with the critics in a big way.
Look, it's not a coherent policy. It's unfortunately a failed policy. And it's a failed policy because of the partners we're dealing with. And, you know, Netanyahu has been a thorn in the U.S. side for a long time. He has at every turn sort of made Israel a more partisan issue here in the United States, essentially gotten in bed with Republicans first in Congress and then in the Trump administration, almost having a fusion between the two. The result of which is that, you know, Biden, with very traditional views going back decades of American support for Israel, a time when that was both a bipartisan core belief and also really it was Democrats even more than Republicans who were the supporters of Israel when Biden first came into office. So I think that, you know, this sort of generational clash is just sort of blown up in Biden's face. He had the view that he would hug Netanyahu close, the bear hug policy, if you will. That has made it harder and harder for him to distance as the war has dragged on. To the point, Jane, about the pier, literally just days before the U.S. announced this remarkable step and also the step of dropping aid from the air into Gaza, you know, we were told by a senior administration official, oh, no, we've looked at that and it would just, it's not effective. It wouldn't work. It's purely symbolic. It would, you know, be a huge problem. And then days later, they announced it. Why the frustration level, the political pain being exacted on Democrats and the White House is just escalating. And I think it's remarkable. I cannot remember anything in decades of watching American foreign policy. I have never seen a U.S. government basically say that we have to bypass a blockade by our own ally in order to provide humanitarian aid. It's a remarkable moment.
At the same time, I do think that it's worth pausing for a minute just to take a look at the remarkable speech that Schumer gave. I mean, it's very unusual to have somebody in his position, he is the senior most elected Jewish official in the country, and he has had no daylight between himself and Israel over the years. He represents the largest sort of concentration of Jews in the country, and he has stepped up to take a very bold position here.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel.
And he's called for a new election. It really is. And you don't, you know, you don't see too many speeches like this. I mean, I think it's interesting to me watching, as someone watching Washington, the thing that that really gets people stars for courage in Washington is when they go against their own tribe. Mm. And they stand up for principle and they say, I'll take the hit. And it's hard to know how much of a hit he will take for this. But going against his own sort of history on this, I think it's a remarkable moment for Chuck Schumer.
It's also a measure of all that has changed since October. Because remember, Schumer came out with a very strong and memorable statement about anti-Semitism right after October 7th. And now here he is today in March. It's really been one of the densest periods of evolution in American sort of foreign policy thinking and domestic politics that I can think of. Susan, what do you think?
The sort of strategic blowback of how Israel has chosen to conduct the conflict and the strategic blow to Israel's standing in the world and therefore to those people who have stood with Israel is much bigger than I think the White House calculated, than the Israeli government calculated. And I think they're really in different places because there is a tendency here in Washington to view this as Netanyahu's war, whereas what I hear from my friends and sources on the ground in Israel is that it is actually a war that is broadly supported by the Israeli population. They experienced a shock akin to 9/11 here in the United States. Biden, interestingly, I think, impressionantly warned them against reacting in a way that the United States did, overreacting to this external shock with a kind of a conflict that would come back to bite them. In many ways, that's what's happened. But there is this gap because I think we think no Netanyahu, no problem. And I'm not sure that's the case. I think Israel is in a very different place than it was in the pre-October 7th world politically. And Israelis are very strongly behind their military, even if polls suggest that they're not very strongly behind Netanyahu as a political leader.
Well, you know, meanwhile, while this is tearing up, you know, the incredibly difficult issue for the Biden administration, it seems like Trump's kind of, you know, slid on it without anybody really holding him accountable for his own position on it. I mean, in the past, he's described himself as the most pro-Israeli, you know, leader in the world. Where is he on this? And, you know, what would he do?
If you pay attention to what Trump is saying, what he's not saying, I think, Jane, you're exactly right that he is not talking a lot about Israel. And that, I think, is by design. One overlooked fact about Trump is that while he was president, he really outsourced American policy to Netanyahu. The two were so close. Netanyahu literally campaigned for re-election at one point with a gigantic billboard of himself with Donald Trump on the side of a building in Israel. But actually, they had a break that was not very appreciated. We only really learned about it after the administration. We were going back and doing reporting for The Divider. And Trump was furious at Netanyahu for coming to the White House and, in Trump's view, upstaging him. And really, that colored relations their entire last year of his presidency. And then when Netanyahu called up Joe Biden and congratulated him on his victory in November of 2020, when Trump was still contesting the election, that just did it for Trump. He's been furious with Bibi ever since. So that it may just be the personal peak, or it may be a calculated sense that, you know, this is Biden's mess to handle, and I don't want to get in the middle of it. Maybe it's both things.
Well, this is why we need debates. Because, you know, you've got to be able to press him on these things. Anyway, in the end of the day, I'd like to hear from each of you. Do you think that foreign policy is going to play a bigger role than usual in this campaign?
It might play a slightly larger role, but I don't think that's what this election hinges on. But I think there's something bigger at play, which is that, you know, really for 80 years, the United States has had a theory of the case about how to be in the world. I mean, it was what Madeleine Albright called the indispensable nation. And Joe Biden has a very strong attachment to that theory, you know, of we are essential. And what it meant was that through the combination of our alliances and our military strength and our support for international institutions, that we didn't have the luxury of backing out of hard problems. And in a way, Donald Trump has revived this gene, this ever-present gene in American history of the instinct for isolation to say, hold on, you know, we're a continental power. Let's just be at home. Why do we have to go out there? And I think it's worth noting, look, for all of the obvious reasons, we are sick of being out there, partly because of the cost and the tragedy of our war in Iraq. That is sort of the, if you had to pick the one thing that was the engine of this transformation, I think it's that. But I think that you also have to recognize that in three decades, in the beginning of the 20th century, we had two world wars. And since then, we have had the ability through this strange and fragile combination of factors of preventing precisely that phenomenon from reemerging. And Donald Trump's vision or lack of vision of what the United States can be in the world is a risk of a kind we really haven't had in any of our lifetimes.
Yeah, I do believe that in many ways, foreign policy, maybe not explicitly in a sense of issues, but foreign policy in a broad sense is, in fact, on the ballot this November. And there are two ways in which I see foreign policy really being a defining issue in 2024. First of all, Joe Biden in the Democratic Party is a kind of last of this generation of Cold War era liberal internationalists. We see that in the Israel debate. I think a different Democratic president might have had different instincts and responses, certainly on Israel. But more broadly, the world is also watching this election and feeling that its fate hinges on what Americans do, in part because we are now the inconstant superpower. And I know, you know, we could get into a blame game here about why that is, but the bottom line is that American credibility is such, we are so internally divided that we cannot say with confidence, here is our policy, and, you know, you can stick to our word. And you can say, well, that's not Joe Biden's fault. I don't think it's Joe Biden's fault. But the bottom line is that this notion of restoring normalcy, of the status quo ante coming back, it's not coming back. And the result is that when the United States says, we're here for you, Ukraine, as long as it takes, that may or may not be true. And that's a crisis, not only for America, it's a crisis for the rest of the world.
Well, when I think of foreign policy elections, you know, I think back on the Daisy ad in 1964 that made the possibility of nuclear war into a major election issue. There have been other sort of national security elections, such as with the same sort of fear idea, you know, the 3 a.m. phone call and the fear that the opponent won't be able to handle a national security crisis. And I mean, I think you could make that argument against Trump. He's such an unreliable leader. But at the same time, since he's been president and there was not a world war while he was in the White House, I think it's going to be a harder sell. Anyway, thanks so much, guys. I think it's been an incredibly interesting conversation on such a complicated subject. That's one of the great things
to go into
about
for
this
sure.
podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. I'm Jane Mayer. And if you have thoughts on the show or questions, please send them to themail@newyorker.com. And don't forget to include The Political Scene in the subject line. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Dan Richards, with editing by Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. And our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. And we will be back next week. Thanks so much for listening.